against its perspective, most annoying increase in power and influence. Uncas also did his best to undermine rival tribes, and the rumors he spread of Narragansett intrigue did much to worsen the tribe's relations with the English. By 1643, Miantonomo had had enough of the Mohegans and their upstart sachem. After an assassination plot against Uncas failed, Miantonomo and 1,000 of his warriors launched an assault on the Mohegans. Prior to the attack, Miantonomo donned a protective iron corselet, but instead of saving his life, the English armor proved his death sentence. When the fighting turned against the Narragansetts and the sachem was forced to flee, he staggered under the weight of the metal breastplate and was easily taken by the enemy. Uncas might have executed Miantonomo on the spot, but the crafty sachem, who was destined to outlive all of the native leaders of his generation, recognized an opportunity to ingratiate himself even further with the English. By 1643, it had become apparent to several prominent New Englanders that Indian-English relations throughout the region needed to be managed in a more coordinated manner. With the rise of native leaders such as Miantonomo and especially Uncas, who had learned to exploit the needs and fears of both the English and the Indians with Machiavellian sophistication, it was important that the English colonies attempt to act as a unified body. Since the boundaries of the colonies had been in dispute from the beginning, cooperation did not necessarily come naturally to the English. But in 1643, with the troubles between the Mohegans and Narragansetts threatening to spread across the region, the United Colonies of New England came into being. The Union included Plymouth, Massachusetts Bay, Connecticut, and New Haven, which would later be absorbed by Connecticut. Each colony sent its own delegation of commissioners to act on its behalf, but only with approval of the individual colony's general courts. Noticeably missing from the Confederation was Roger Williams's Rhode Island, the only non-Puritan colony in New England. Edward Winslow appears to have had an important role in creating the United Colonies, a combination for which it is difficult to find an English precedent. In Holland, however, there had been a similar confederation of independent states since 1579, and the Pilgrims may have introduced the concept to their Puritan counterparts from Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Haven. According to John Quincy Adams, the United Colonies of 1643 was the model and prototype of the North American Confederacy of 1774, which in turn became the basis of the United States. More than 100 years before the colonies' growing tensions with England provided the impetus to create a confederation, the United Colonies of New England demonstrated the importance of looking beyond local concerns and prejudices. If Miantonomo had succeeded in accomplishing the same kind of combination for the Native Americans of the region, the history of New England might have been very different. Miantonomo was still in Uncas's custody when the commissioners of the United Colonies met for the first time in Hartford, Connecticut, on September 7, 1643. And Uncas asked the commissioners what he should do with the Narragansett sachem. By appealing to what was for all intents and purposes the Puritan nation of New England, Uncas had given the Mohegans truly region-wide exposure and influence. After extensive deliberations, the commissioners decided to let Uncas do what he wanted with Miantonomo. There is evidence that the Narragansett sachem attempted one last bid to unite the native peoples of New England by proposing that he marry one of Uncas's sisters. It was, however, too late for a reconciliation, and on the path between Hartford and Windsor, Connecticut, Uncas's brother walked up behind Miantonomo and clave his head with a hatchet. For the time being, the threat of a united native assault against Puritan and Pilgrim New England had been laid to rest. Chapter 11. The Ancient Mother. By the early 1640s, the Great Migration had come to an end as England was torn apart by civil war. Many settlers returned to England to join in Parliament's efforts to overthrow King Charles's repressive regime. With the king's execution in 1649, England became a Puritan state, unimaginable just a decade before. Bradford felt compelled to turn to an early page in his History of Plymouth and write, "Full little did I think that the downfall of the bishops, with their courts, canons and ceremonies, etc., had been so near when I first began these scribbled writings, or that I should have lived to have seen or hear of the same. But it is the Lord's doing, and ought to be marvelous in our eyes." Until this spectacular turn of events, it had been possible for a Puritan to believe that America was where God planned the apocalyptic series of events that would anticipate the millennium. Now it seemed that England was the true center stage, and those who had ventured to the New World were in danger of being left out of the most critical events of their time. In addition to putting Puritan New England's raison d'être into question, the Civil War endangered the region's economy. Pilgrims who had watched the prices of their cattle and crops skyrocket over the last decade were suddenly left with a surplus that was worth barely a quarter of what it had commanded in the 1630s. More than a few New Englanders decided that it was time to return to the mother country, and one of those was Edward Winslow. From the very beginning, Winslow had shown a talent for getting what he wanted, whether it was the hand of the widow Susanna White, just a few weeks after the death of his own wife, or winning back the loyalty of Massasoit. For 2.5 decades, he had conducted a kind of shuttle diplomacy between America and England as he spearheaded negotiations with merchants and government officials in London. He was also valued by Massachusetts Bay for his diplomatic savvy, even if some found the peripatetic pilgrim a little too glib for his own good. Samuel Maverick was an Anglican who had once lived on an island in Boston Harbor, and he later remembered the pilgrim diplomat as a smooth-tongued, cunning fellow. In 1646, Winslow sailed for England on yet another diplomatic mission. His talents came to the notice of the Puritan regime of Oliver Cromwell, and as happened to Benjamin Franklin in the following century, the pilgrim diplomat kept postponing his return to America as he became caught up in the historical destiny of his country. To Bradford's bitter regret, Winslow never returned to Plymouth. In 1654, he was named commissioner of a British naval effort against the Spanish in the West Indies. A year later, he succumbed to yellow fever off the island of Jamaica and was buried at sea with full honors. Winslow undoubtedly looked to his final decade in England as his shining hour as a diplomat. But his most significant contribution to British and American history had actually occurred more than 30 years earlier, when he became the Englishman Massasoit trusted above all others. By the time Bradford received word of Winslow's passing, Elder William Brewster had been dead for more than a decade. A year later, in 1656, Miles Standish died in his home in Duxbury. In 1656, Bradford was 68 years old. According to the patent issued by the Council for New England, he might have become the sole proprietor of the colony back in 1630. Instead, he had shared his rights with those who had come to America during the first years of the colony. 10 years later, in 1640, Bradford and the other old comers turned the patent over to the colony's freemen. He had come to America not to establish a great and powerful colony, but to create a tightly knit and godly community. For that to happen, everyone must live together and worship in the same church. But by the early 1630s, it had become apparent that the soil around the original settlement was not the best. Many inhabitants, moreover, claimed they needed more land to accommodate the growing herds of cattle. To the governor's dismay, many of his closest associates, including Brewster, Winslow, Standish, and John Alden, left Plymouth to found communities to the north in Duxbury and Marshfield. Thomas Prince, one of the colony's rising stars, and who first served as governor in 1634, also moved to Duxbury, then helped found the town of Eastham on Cape Cod. Although he didn't arrive in New England until the 1630s, John Brown was one of the colony's wealthier inhabitants. He would probably have joined the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay had not a meeting with John Robinson in Leyden in the 1620s caused him to choose Plymouth instead. In 1640, Brown helped found the town of Taunton. By 1645 he had moved to Wanamoisett, in the vicinity of modern Barrington, Rhode Island, which became a part of Swansea in 1667. By that time, Brown had long since been joined by his son James and his son-in-law Thomas Willett, who established a prosperous trade with the Dutch in Manhattan. At the root of this trend toward town building was, Governor Bradford insisted, a growing hunger for land. For Bradford, land had been a way to create a community of saints. For an increasing number of pilgrims, and especially for their children, land was a way to get rich. Bradford claimed that the formation of new towns was not for want or necessity, but for the enriching of themselves, and he predicted it would be the ruin of New England. Even Roger Williams, whose vision of an ideal community was very different from Bradford's, shared his concern about land. Williams railed against the rise of Godland in New England, and feared that it would become as great with us English as God gold was with the Spaniards. It was difficult for Bradford not to take the exodus of Winslow, Brewster, and the others as a personal affront. For as the new towns prospered and grew, Plymouth, the village with which it had all begun, fell on hard times. And thus was this poor church left, Bradford wrote, like an ancient mother grown old and forsaken of her children. Thus she that had made many rich became herself poor. Despite Bradford's lament, his vision of a compact, self-contained community of fellow worshippers remained the organizing principle behind each of the colony's new towns. In 1652, Plymouth magistrates admonished one Joseph Ramsden for locating his house remotely in the woods from his neighbors, and ordered him to bring his wife and family with all convenient speed near unto some neighborhood. A settler in a typical town in Plymouth Colony in the 1650s received a house lot that ranged from just a single acre to as much as 20, depending on his social standing. Instead of the tiny wattle and daub cottages constructed by the original pilgrims, the subsequent generation built post and beam structures covered with clapboards and shingles and anchored by mammoth brick chimneys. It took a tremendous amount of lumber to build one of these houses. Even a modest house required at least 12 tons of wood. Just as daunting were the heating requirements of the home's open hearth. It's been estimated that the average 17th century New England house consumed 15 cords or 1,920 cubic feet of wood per year, meaning that a town of 200 homes depended on the deforestation of as many as 75 acres per year. As the number of towns grew, the character of the colony inevitably began to change, and from Governor Bradford's perspective, it was not for the good. The influx of newcomers made it increasingly difficult to ensure the colony's moral purity. Even worse than the cases of premarital sex and adultery were, according to Bradford, those of sodomy and buggery. In 1642, 17-year-old Thomas Granger, a servant to an honest man of Duxbury, was convicted of having sexual relations with a mare, a cow, 2 goats, 5 sheep, 2 calves, and a turkey. Taking their lead from Leviticus, Bradford and his fellow magistrates executed Granger on September 8, 1642, but not until the boy had witnessed the killing of his animal paramours, which were all buried in a pit. Bradford speculated that Satan hath more power in these heathen lands, but he also feared that a pernicious complacency had infected the colony. In 1655, Governor Bradford delivered an ultimatum. If his subordinates did not do something to improve the spiritual state of the colony, he must resign his office. Promises were made, and Bradford continued on as governor, but that did not prevent a profound despair from overtaking him in his final years. Late in life, Bradford looked back on the manuscript pages of his History of the Colony, beside a copy of a letter written by Pastor Robinson and Elder Brewster back in 1617, in which they referred to their congregation's most strict and sacred bond. Bradford wrote, I have been happy in my first times to see, and with much comfort to enjoy, the blessed fruits of this sweet communion. But it is now a part of my misery in old age to find and feel the decay, and, with grief and sorrow of heart, to lament and bewail the same. There may have been another dimension to Bradford's sadness, a sadness that reached back to his decision in 1620 to leave his son John in Holland. After his second marriage in 1623, Bradford and his wife Alice had been blessed with three children: William Jr., born in 1624, Mercy in 1627, and Joseph in 1630. Bradford adopted Alice's two sons, Constant and Thomas Southworth, as well as 18-year-old Thomas Cushman when his father Robert died at about the same time as Robinson's death in 1625. Other members of Bradford's extended family included the boys Nathaniel Morton, Joseph Rogers, and William Latham. But as late as 1627, there was one missing member. John, Bradford's son from his first marriage with Dorothy, was still in Europe. By the time he finally did join his father, John was 11 years old. He had been just 3 when he had last seen his parents, and he must have had little memory of his father. Bradford's stepson, Nathaniel Morton, was almost precisely John's age. But while Morton became the governor's right-hand man in the years ahead, John, his firstborn, drifted, eventually moving to Norwich, Connecticut, about as far away from the home of his famous father as it was possible for a New Englander to get. No one knew what the future held, but Bradford had his suspicions. If New England continued its degenerate ways, God would surely wreak his vengeance. In Bradford's view, the seeds for this terrible apocalypse had been sown more than 30 years before, when Thomas Morton of Marymount had begun selling guns to the Indians. Almost immediately, the natives had become more effective huntsmen than the English, by reason of their swiftness of foot and nimbleness of body, being also quick-sighted, and by continual exercise, well knowing the haunts of all sorts of game. They were also quick to master the mechanical aspects of operating a musket, and were soon able to perform their own repairs and manufacture their own lead bullets. The conservatism of the English made it difficult for them to abandon their old and cumbersome matchlock muskets for the newer flintlocks. The Indians, on the other hand, knew from the start that they wanted only flintlocks. "They became mad, as it were, after them," Bradford wrote, "and would not stick to give any price they could attain to for them, accounting their bows and arrows but baubles in comparison of them." Suddenly, the English were no longer the technological superiors of the Native Americans. And when they happened on the Indians in the woods armed with guns in this sort, it was a terror unto them. Over time, however, the English became accustomed to the sight of an Indian with a gun. Indians armed with flintlocks brought in more game and furs to English trading posts. And besides, if the Indians did not get their weapons from the English, they could easily buy them from the French and the Dutch. Selling guns and ammunition was a highly profitable business, and Plymouth magistrates eventually came to sanction the exchange. From Governor Bradford's perspective, the arming of the Indians was just another symptom of the alarming complacency that had gripped his colony. New England was headed for a fall, and it was the gun-toting Indians who would be the rod with which the Lord punished his people. "For these fierce natives, they are now so filled with guns and muskets, and in them so skilled, as that they may keep the English in awe, and when they please, give unto them the law." The last days of Bradford's life were spent in what might seem a strange pursuit for the governor of a New England colony: studying Hebrew. He yearned to have as direct a connection as possible with the Word of God, and to do that, he must learn the language in which the Bible was originally written. The initial pages of his Plymouth history are filled with a doodle-like scrawl of Hebrew words and phrases. "Though I am grown aged," he wrote, "yet I have had a longing desire to see with my own eyes something of that most ancient language and holy tongue, in which the law and oracles of God were written.